All right, here we are, day three, audiobook slash podcast slash experimental media.
So true, man. Never been done before, so this is, I never do anything like anybody else does it.
Yeah, and this is a really fun experience. I hope the listener's enjoying it, just being able to talk it out in real time as we read through it. I find it, it's fun for me and keeps it fresh, I think, as well. And it must be kind of a trip for you to hear your life story that you wrote read back to you.
Oh, it is crazy. I mean, it's, you know, I sit back and sometimes I'm speechless and you ask me a question and this is totally, you know, we're having a conversation, me and you. This is off the cuff. This isn't rehearsed. And some of the questions you may ask me, man, I'm sitting back thinking, good God, man, did I really go through that shit, you know? And, you know, we'll get to all the interviews we had because so many stories we have in here, you know, a lot of people may say, oh, that shit didn't happen or that didn't happen. And we interviewed, what, 30 people?
Yeah.
Around there?
At least that.
Yeah. So, you know, we had a lot of people interviewed because every story that's in this book is, I had to make sure that it was validated, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, the fact checking was done and every story has been validated. We talked, I mean, you know, I actually went and visited the Buds compound.
Yep.
You know, and speaking with some of your ex platoon mates and a lot of people who aren't even in the book that we spoke to.
Right. You know, we have Drew Sheets that we talked about in the last chapter.
Yep.
Or he went in the last chapter. You know, I just kind of brought up Drew Sheets at the very end. And, you know, we talked to him for about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And didn't even use his material because we had so much in here.
Yeah, and there's more like him. Before we start getting into chapter 7, which I think is a really pivotal chapter here, because it encapsulates something that I know is extremely important to you, just in terms of the mind and how powerful it is, and how many of us don't tap into its full power. And I know we want to get into that, but you wanted to talk about something else before that.
Yeah, the whole big thing I'd like to talk about, you know, before we get into the mind is procrastination. And I was just thinking about this morning. I had this guy in the gym, you know, he came up to me when I was leaving. He's like, hey, are you David Goggins? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm David Goggins. He goes, I'm going to go run a 50 miler one day. I'm going to do a 50 miler one day. And I'm like, hey, man, you know, why don't you go online, you know, Google some 50 milers and sign up for it. He's like, well, you know, I need to, you know, get a big, big training block, maybe put a year of training into it. And I'm sitting there thinking the whole time, man, that's exactly what people do, you know, is they like to have their mind fool them. You know, I need so much preparation. I need so much training. I need so much time. And all that does is that he will sit back and he'll start procrastinating on that same idea. So that's what brought the whole, you know, procrastinating thing up.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a writer, I know procrastination rather well. It's part of the deal.
Right.
But, you know, I don't love it. It's definitely something that I do indulge in too much sometimes. Sometimes the power of a deadline makes it, you know, the deadline is kind of this hammer that's kind of ready to swing. So you can't procrastinate when the deadline is kind of breathing down your neck.
Right.
But there are some people who consider procrastination to be part of the process, certainly in a creative work where, sometimes you're just not ready. It might mean you haven't really thought out all the beats to a story or to a song, and you do need to kind of, mull it over. And even if you're not thinking of it consciously, there's an unconscious part of you that's still mulling it over. And it's this natural process that we all, tap into sometimes. But I think the same is also true that's only true. Procrastination is only a productive process if you eventually produce the material, which means getting your ass to work.
Right. And you know what happens in, you know, like I'm during procrastination, that so-called phase that some theorists think that you need is, you start overthinking. And then when you start overthinking something, man, you start going down that serious spiral of, oh, you know what? Maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I shouldn't do it. And the one thing that helped me out so much was I pushed myself so far back in a corner when I was almost 300 pounds, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to go be a Navy SEAL, I had the bright idea to go try to be a Navy SEAL. And when that recruiter told me, hey, you have under 3 months to lose 106 pounds, I didn't have that, you know, that whole phase of procrastination that people say you're supposed to go through. That phase got eliminated.
Yes, but there was that. I have to push back just to see what you say about this, though. Because remember, you did in your mind say, well, listen, I'm going to do the ASVAB part of it first. And you did that 2 weeks before you started to really get into your running routine.
Right.
You were still on the cockroach duty and you were doing the ASVAB. That kind of was your little procrastination piece, wasn't it?
You know, I guess you can call it procrastination, but for me to go back to the ASVAB test,
yeah,
I'd rather run 400 million miles than sit my butt down and start studying for the ASVAB test again.
So you were just cramming the whole time.
Right. So for me, how my mind works is a lot of us, we are, especially nowadays, people can multitask big time.
Yeah.
Which to me makes you half-assed at a lot of shit.
Yeah.
I have to, so my brain, the way it works, if I don't put all of my time and energy to what's in front of me, I have to be hyper-focused and put everything. So I put everything into studying. Mm. Everything had to be into studying. Because if I was half-assed in my studying and then going out and then trying to work out, my mind would have been split into two spots. And that wouldn't have been great for me. So I knew that I had to put a lot of time into learning, you know, this ASVAB book again.
And you had that, even though you didn't pass that, that became the base level, which then you were able to kind of supplement as you started to work out hard on the exercise bike. But you already kind of laid a foundation for the supplementing of the studying.
Exactly. Because without the ASVAB, I could lose 200 pounds.
Right.
I wasn't getting in the military.
No.
So that was the first big step.
Yeah. I mean, I just started thinking something. It's like, so many of us are so busy multitasking, we don't do shit.
Exactly. It's a true statement. Nowadays, these millennials, man, they can multitask their ass off. You know, and that's kind of old school knuckle draggers, man. You know, we're like fixed pointed on one object and get after it. And there's another thing I want to talk about before we get going in the book is I'm all about change. I'm really about change. When I had a fixed mindset, a fixed mindset to me is one of the worst mindsets you can possibly have. And we change our life, you know, so in our lives, we change our house, we change our car, we change our clothes, we change our hairstyle. Sometimes we change our wives, our husbands, you know, we change so much, but very rarely do we change the way we think. And that right there is what I realized throughout this whole book. If I didn't change the way I thought about what was in front of me, about all the obstacles that, you know, whatever put in front of me, God put in front of me, people put in front of me, I put in front of me. If I didn't change the way I thought about, let me take a step back and figure out how I can go through it or around it or over it versus saying, oh, I see a wall. Let me just stop. Hmm. Now when I see a wall, I look for a door. I look for a window. I look for a way. I look for a little crack to say, maybe I can chip away at that wall to get through it. So that's in my mind now. My mind is not like I see a wall, and obviously the wall is something that we have in our mind that then says, oh, I'm going to stop right here because this is just too much. I'm open-minded to believe that there's a way through that wall. Hmm. And that's something about, you know, with procrastination, with mindset, with change, we have to change the way we think. And very few of us are willing to do that.
Yeah, and what I love about the way you're approaching this is you're not pointing the finger and saying, you don't do this, I do this, you don't do what I do. No, you've lived through all of this. You've done all of these things. You have procrastinated. You have doubted yourself.
Yeah.
You have succumbed to self-doubt.
Right.
You have been backed into the corner that you put yourself in.
Exactly.
And then you also rose out of it because you were able to systematically shift how you approached your own mind.
And you know what? And that's why I talk about it so much, Adam, is I'm not this guy who's like, you know, calling people out,
no,
judging people. No, man, I know exactly where the hell you're at. If you're going through a problem mentally, 9 times out of 10, I've been exactly where you're at. So I'm not judging you. I'm trying to give you tips on how to get through that daggone obstacle, which is your mind. And a lot of people think I'm crazy. Nah, I'm not crazy. I'm just not like you. That's all it is. I'm just not like you. So once again, it goes back to the title. Trying to put a title on something that you don't understand. I'm not crazy. We're just different people, and I'm just not like you. But we have a lot more to cover here, man. I'm looking forward to hearing the next chapter.
Chapter 7, The Most Powerful Weapon. 27 hours after savoring intense, gratifying pain and basking in the afterglow of my greatest achievement so far, I was back at my desk on a Monday morning. SBG was my commanding officer, and I had his permission and every known excuse to take a few days off. Instead, swollen, sore, and miserable, I pulled myself out of bed, hobbled into work, and later that morning called Chris Kostman. I've been looking forward to this. I imagined the sweet note of surprise in his voice after hearing that I'd taken his challenge and run 101 miles in less than 24 hours. Perhaps there'd even be some overdue respect as he made my entry to Badwater official. Instead, my call went to voicemail. I left him a polite message he never returned, and 2 days later, I dropped him an email. "Sir, how are you doing? I ran the 100 miles needed to qualify in 18 hours and 56 minutes. I would like to know now what I need to do to get into the Badwater, so we can begin raising money for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Thanks again." His reply came in the next day, and it threw me way the fuck off. "Congrats on your 100-mile finish. But did you actually stop then? The point of a 24-hour event is to run for 24 hours. Anyway, stay tuned for the announcement that you can apply. The race will be July 24th to the 26th. Best regards, Chris Kostman." I couldn't help but take his response personally. On a Wednesday, he suggested I run 100 miles in 24 hours that Saturday. I got it done in less time than he required, and he still wasn't impressed. Kostman was a veteran of ultra races, so he knew that strewn behind me were a dozen performance barriers and pain thresholds I'd shattered. Obviously, none of that meant much to him. I cooled off for a week before I rode him back, and in the meantime looked into other races to bolster my resume. There were very few available that late in the year. I found a 50-miler on Catalina, but only triple digits would impress a guy like Kostman. Plus, it had been a full week since the San Diego One Day, and my body was still monumentally fucked. I hadn't run 3 feet since finishing mile 101. My frustration flashed with the cursor as I crafted my rebuttal. "Thanks for emailing me back. I see that you enjoy talking about as much as I do. The only reason why I'm still bugging you is because this race and the cause behind it is important. If you have any other qualifying races that you think I should do, please let me know. Thanks for letting me know I'm supposed to run the full 24 hours. Next time, I'll be sure to do that." It took him another full week to respond, and he didn't offer a hell of a lot more hope, but at least he salted it with sarcasm. "Hi, David. If you could do some more ultras between now and January 3rd to the 24th, the application period, great. If not, submit the best possible application during the January 3rd to 24th window and cross your fingers. Thanks for your enthusiasm. Chris." At this point, I was starting to like Chris Kostman a lot better than my chances of getting into Badwater. What I didn't know, because he never mentioned it, is that Kostman was one of the 5 people on the Badwater Admissions Committee, which reviews upwards of 1,000 applications a year. Each judge scores every application, and based on their cumulative scores, the top 90 applicants get in on merit. From the sounds of it, my resume was thin. I wouldn't crack the top 90. On the other hand, Kostman held 10 wild cards in his back pocket. He could have already guaranteed me a spot, but for some reason he kept pushing me. Once again, I'd have to prove myself beyond a minimum standard to get a fair shake. To become a SEAL, I had to deal with 3 hell weeks. And now, if I really wanted to run Badwater and raise money for families in need, I was going to have to find a way to make my application bulletproof. Based on a link he sent along with his reply, I found one more ultra race scheduled before the Badwater application was due. It was called the Hurt 100, and the name did not lie. one of the toughest 100-mile trail races in the world. It was set in a triple canopy rainforest on the island of Oahu. To cross the finish line, I'd have to run up and down 24,500 vertical feet. That's some Himalayan shit. I stared at the race profile. It was all sharp spikes and deep dives. It looked like an arrhythmic EKG. I couldn't do this race cold. There's no way I could finish it without at least some training, but by early December, I was still in so much agony that walking up the stairs to my apartment was pure torture. The following weekend, I zoomed up Interstate 15 to Vegas for the Las Vegas Marathon. It wasn't spur of the moment. Months before, I'd ever heard the word San Diego one day. Kate, my mom, and I had circled December 5th on our calendars. It was 2005, the first year that the Las Vegas Marathon started on the Strip, and we wanted to be part of that shit. Except I never trained for it. Then the San Diego one day happened, and by the time we got to Vegas, I had no illusions about my fitness level. I tried to run the morning before we left, but I still had stress fractures in my feet. My medial tendons were wobbly, and even while wrapped with a special bandage I'd found that could stabilize my ankles, I couldn't last longer than a quarter mile. So I didn't plan on running as we rocked up to the Mandalay Bay Casino and Resort on race day. It was a beautiful morning. Music was pumping. There were thousands of smiling faces in the street. The clean desert air had a chill to it, and the sun was shining. Running conditions don't get much better, and Kate was ready to go. Her goal was to break 5 hours, and for once, I was satisfied being a cheerleader. My mom had always planned on walking it, and I figured I'd stroll with her for as long as I could, then hail a cab to the finish line and cheer my ladies to the tape. The three of us towed up with the masses as the clock struck 7 a.m., and someone got on the mic to begin the official countdown. 10, 9, 8. When he hit 1, a horn sounded, and like Pavlov's dog, something clicked inside me. I still don't know what it was. Perhaps I underestimated my competitive spirit. Maybe it was because I knew Navy SEALs were supposed to be the hardest motherfuckers in the world. We were supposed to run on broken legs and fractured feet. Or so went the legend I bought into long ago. Whatever it was, something triggered, and the last thing I remember seeing as the horn echoed down the street was shock and real concern on the faces of Kate and my mother as I charged down the boulevard and out of sight. The pain was serious for the first quarter mile, but after that, adrenaline took over. I hit the first mile marker at 7:10 and kept running like the asphalt was melting behind me. 10 kilometers into the race, my time was around 43 minutes. That's solid. But I wasn't focused on the clock, because considering how I'd felt the day before, I was still in total disbelief that I'd actually run 6.2 miles. My body was broken. How was this happening? Most people in my condition would have both feet in soft casts, and here I was running a marathon. I got to mile 13, the halfway point, and saw the official clock. It read 1 hour, 35 minutes, 55 seconds. I did the math and realized that I was in the hunt to qualify for the Boston Marathon, but was right on the cusp. In order to qualify in my age group, I had to finish in under 3 hours, 10 minutes, and 59 seconds. I laughed in disbelief and slammed a paper cup of Gatorade. In less than 2 hours, the game had flipped, and I might never get this chance again. I'd seen so much death by then, in my personal life and on the battlefield, that I knew tomorrow was not guaranteed. Before me was an opportunity, and if you give me an opportunity, I will break that motherfucker off. It wasn't easy. I'd surfed an adrenaline wave for the first 13 miles, but I felt every inch of the second half, and at mile 18, I hit a wall. That's a common theme in marathon running, because mile 18 is usually when a runner's glycogen levels run low, and I was bonking, my lungs heaving. My legs felt like I was running in deep Saharan sand. I needed to stop and take a break, but I refused, and 2 hard miles later, I felt rejuvenated. I reached the next clock at mile 22. I was still in the hunt for Boston, though I'd fallen 30 seconds off the pace, and to qualify, the final 4 miles would have to be my very best. I dug deep, kicked my thighs up high, and lengthened my stride. I was a man possessed as I turned the final corner and charged toward the finish line at the Mandalay Bay. Thousands of people had assembled on the sidewalk cheering. It was all a beautiful blur to me as I sprinted home. I ran my last 2 miles at a sub-7-minute pace, finished the race in just over 3 hours and 8 minutes, and qualified for Boston. Somewhere on the streets of Las Vegas, my wife and mother would deal with their own struggles and overcome them to finish too, and as I sat on a patch of grass waiting for them, I contemplated another simple question I couldn't shake. It was a new one, and wasn't fear-based, pain-spiked, or self-limiting. This one felt open. What am I capable of? SEAL training had pushed me to the brink several times, but whenever it beat me down, I popped up to take another pounding. That experience made me hard, but it also left me wanting more of the same, and day-to-day Navy SEAL life just wasn't like that. Then came San Diego one day, and now this. I'd finished a marathon at an elite pace for a weekend warrior, when I had no business even walking a mile. Both were incredible physical feats that didn't seem possible, but they'd happened. What am I capable of? I couldn't answer that question, but as I looked around the finish line that day and considered what I'd accomplished, it became clear that we are all leaving a lot of money on the table without realizing it. We habitually settle for less than our best, at work, in school, in our relationships, and on the playing field or race course. We settle as individuals, and we teach our children to settle for less than their best, and all of that ripples out, merges and multiplies within our communities and society as a whole. We're not talking some bad weekend in Vegas, no more cash at the ATM kind of loss either. In that moment, the cost of missing out on so much excellence in this eternally fucked up world felt incalculable to me. And it still does. I haven't stopped thinking about it since. David, you want to talk about that a little bit?
I do. This was this set the bar to a whole new level for me. And I started realizing right here, the one thing that separates all of us is our mindset. And I was open-minded to the possibility that I had the ability to conquer anything.
This is kind of where it first starts to, like, you even open it even wider beyond, because up until this point, you're still working within a template of the Navy SEAL template, which is, this is the Navy SEALs telling you, no, you're bigger than this. We'll get you to the point where you can fill our box.
Right.
But now you're breaking out of that box.
And that's what I started realizing was exactly what you said. When you become a Navy SEAL, you believe that is the pinnacle of mental toughness, of mental hardness, of you're the baddest of the bad. And I started realizing I hadn't even tapped into the beginning of this journey yet. Mm-hmm. And the first 100-mile race I did was zero training. And then this marathon, being able to run that fast. And I'm telling you right now, those of you who are listening, I was so broken. Like the day before, I could not, no way in hell, run a quarter of a mile. And I know people, oh yeah, right. There's no way in hell. So you can run 26.2 miles. Mm. That's exactly what kind of flipped me out. I realized I was leaving, just like we put here, I was leaving so much on the daggone table. And those questions did come up in my mind. What the hell? If I'm able to do all these things just off of changing my mindset, just off of, you know, going out there and believing, but it's much more than believing, much more than believing, just realizing that I'm not using all of my mind. And I realized that, and it kept on getting worse and worse and worse as I went.
And a lot of us aren't, which we're going to get into in more detail here. But I like this idea of it's not just you, it's everyone. And what is that? And we all know this world, this society, it's not running tip top.
No.
You know, we got a lot of problems out here. And imagine what we could do if everyone was at the top of their game, if everyone was pushing harder. To me, it seems like things would be happier. I mean, maybe that's just pie in the sky. We don't really know. But to me, it seems like if this is the way things are, this is the status quo, then, and if everyone starts pushing a little harder, doing a little bit more for themselves and for others, I mean, what would happen?
You know what?
And what are we capable of, basically?
Right. And that is it. And I found true happiness on the other end of suffering. And a lot of us, we have to stop giving in to that feeling in our mind that says stop. And it's all relative. But you have to stop. Like when that mind starts telling you to stop, trust me, there's a lot left in the tank. And everybody wants to find peace. That's one thing about life. We all want to find peace so fast, but we don't want to go through, you know, all that hard stuff to find peace. Now, if hard stuff is kind of doing some of the stuff I did, and I'm not saying go out there and run 100 miles, run 200 miles, go through SEAL training, but you cannot leave so much in the tank and just live a normal life. You have to explore yourself, explore your mind, explore your body, explore your soul, explore the limits to the human soul. And that's what it's all about in life.
Physically, I bounced back from Vegas within a few days, meaning I was back to my new normal, dealing with the same serious yet tolerable pain I'd come home to after the San Diego one day. The aches were still there by the following Saturday, but I was done convalescing. I needed to start training, or I'd burn out on the trail during the Hurt 100, and there would be no bad water. I'd been reading up on how to prepare for ultras, and knew it was vital to get in some 100-mile weeks. I only had about a month to build my strength and endurance before race day on January 14th. My feet and shins weren't even close to right, so I came up with a new method to stabilize both the bones in my feet and my tendons. I bought high-performance inserts, cut them down to fit flush with the soles of my feet, and taped my ankles, heels, and lower shins with compression tape. I also slid a small heel wedge into my shoes to correct my running posture and ease pressure. After what I'd endured, it took a lot of props to get me running nearly pain-free. Getting 100-mile weeks in while holding down a steady job isn't easy, but that was no excuse. My 16-mile commute to work from Chula Vista to Coronado became my go-to run. Chula Vista had a split personality when I lived there. There was the nicer, newer, middle-class section where we lived, which was surrounded by a concrete jungle of gritty, dangerous streets. That's the part I ran through at dawn, beneath freeway overpasses and alongside Home Depot shipping bays. This was not your tourist brochure's version of sunny San Diego. I sniffed car exhaust and rotting garbage, spotted skittering rats, and dodged sleepless homeless camps before reaching Imperial Beach, where I picked up the 7-mile Silver Strand bike path. It banked south past Coronado's landmark hotel, the turn-of-the-century Hotel Del Coronado, and a crop of luxury condo towers which overlooked the same wide strip of sand, shared by Naval Special Warfare Command, where I spent the day jumping out of airplanes and shooting guns. I was living the Navy SEAL legend, trying to keep it real. I ran that 16-mile stretch at least 3 times a week. Some days I ran home too, and on Fridays I added a ruck run. Inside the radio pouch of my standard-issue rucksack, I slid 2 25-pound weights and ran fully loaded for as many as 20 miles to build quad strength. I loved waking up at 5 a.m. and starting work with 3 hours of cardio already in the bank while most of my teammates hadn't even finished their coffee. It gave me a mental edge, a better sense of self-awareness, and a ton of self-confidence, which made me a better SEAL instructor. That's what getting up at the ass crack of dawn and putting out will do for you. It makes you better in all facets of your life. During my first real-deal week of training, I ran 77 miles. The following week, I ran 109 miles, including a 12-mile run on Christmas Day. The next week, I pushed it to 111.5, including a 19-mile run on New Year's Day. And the following week, I backed off to taper my legs, but still got 56.5 miles in. All of those were road miles, but what I had coming up was a trail run, and I had never run on a trail before. I bushwhacked a bunch, but I hadn't run distance on single track with a clock running. The Hurt 100 was a 20-mile circuit course, and I'd heard that only a slim slice of those who start the race finish all 5 laps. This was my last chance to pad my Badwater resume. I had a lot riding on a successful outcome, and there was so much about the race and about ultra running that I still didn't know. I flew into Honolulu a few days early and checked into the Halakoa, a military hotel where active duty and veterans stay with their families when they come through town. I'd studied the maps and knew the basics when it came to the terrain, but I hadn't seen it up close, so I drove over to the Hawaii Nature Center the day before the race and stared into the velvety Jade Mountains. All I could see was a steep cut of red earth disappearing into the dense green. I walked up the trail for a half mile, but there was only so far I could hike. I was tapering, and the first mile was straight uphill. Everything beyond that would have to remain a mystery for a little longer. There were just 3 aid stations on the 20-mile course, and most athletes were self-reliant and dialed in their own nutritional regimen. I was still a neophyte and had no clue what I needed when it came to fuel. I met a woman at the hotel at 5:30 a.m. on race day morning as we were about to leave. She knew I was a rookie and asked what I'd brought with me to keep myself going. I showed her my meager stash of flavored energy gels and my Camelback. "You didn't bring salt pills?" she asked, shocked. I shrugged. I didn't know what the fuck a salt pill was. She poured 100 of them into my palm. "Take 2 of these every hour. They'll keep you from cramping." "Roger that." She smiled and shook her head like she could see my fucked up future. I had a strong start and felt great, but not long after the race began, I knew I was facing a monster course. I'm not talking about the grade and elevation variance. I expected that. It was all the rocks and roots that took me by surprise. I was lucky that it hadn't rained in a couple of days, because all I had to wear were my standard running shoes, which had precious little tread. Then my Camelback broke at mile 6. I shook it off and kept hammering, but without a water source, I'd have to rely on the aid stations to hydrate, and they were spaced miles apart. I didn't even have my support crew of one yet. Kate was chilling on the beach and didn't plan on showing up until later in the race, which was my own fault. I enticed her to come along by promising a vacation, and early that morning I insisted she enjoy Hawaii and leave the suffering to me. With or without a Camelback, my mindset was to make it from aid station to aid station and see what happens. Before the race started, I heard people talking about Carl Meltzer. I'd seen him stretching out and warming up. His nickname was the Speed Goat, and he was trying to become the first person ever to complete the race in less than 24 hours. For the rest of us, there was a 36-hour time limit. My first lap took 4.5 hours, and I felt okay afterwards, which was to be expected considering all the long days I'd done in preparation. But I was also concerned, because each lap demanded an ascent and descent of around 5,000 vertical feet, and the amount of focus it took to pay attention to every step so I didn't turn an ankle amped up my mental fatigue. Each time my medial tendon twinged, it felt like a raw nerve exposed to the wind, and I knew one stumble could fold my wobbly ankle and end my race. I felt that pressure every single moment, and as a result, I burned more calories than expected, which was a problem because I had very little fuel, and without a water source, I couldn't hydrate effectively. Between laps, I guzzled water, and with my belly sloshing, started my second loop with a slow jog up that 1-mile-long, 800-foot climb into the mountains, basically straight uphill. That's when it started to rain. Our red earth trail became mud within minutes. The soles of my shoes were coated with it and slick as skis. I sloshed through shin-deep puddles, skidded down descents, and slipped on ascents. It was a full-body sport, but at least there was water. Whenever I was dry, I tipped my head back, opened wide, and tasted the rain, which filtered through a triple-canopy jungle that smelled of leaf rot and shit. The feral funk of fertility invaded my nostrils, and all I could think of was the fact that I had to run 4 more fucking laps. At mile 30, my body reported some positive news. Or maybe it was the physical manifestation of a backhanded compliment. The tendon pain in my ankles had vanished because my feet had swollen enough to stabilize those tendons. Was this a good thing long term? Probably not, but you take what you can get on the ultra circuit, where you have to roll with whatever gets you from mile to mile. Meanwhile, my quads and calves ached like they'd been thumped with a sledgehammer. Yeah, I had done a lot of running, but most of it, including my ruck runs, on pancake flat terrain in San Diego, not on slick jungle trails. Kate was waiting for me by the time I completed my second lap, and after spending a relaxing morning on Waikiki Beach, she watched in horror as I materialized from the mist like a zombie from The Walking Dead. I sat and guzzled as much water as I could. By then, word had gotten out that it was my first trail race. Have you ever had a very public fuck-up, or were in the midst of a shitty day, week, month, year? Yet people around you felt obliged to comment on the source of your humiliation? Maybe they reminded you of all the ways you could have ensured a very different outcome. Now imagine consuming that negativity, but having to run 60 more miles in the sweaty jungle rain on top of it. Does that sound like fun? Yeah, I was the talk of the race. Well, me and Carl Meltzer. Nobody could believe he was gunning for a sub-24-hour experience, and it was equally baffling that I showed up to one of the most treacherous trail races on the planet, undersupplied and unprepared, with no trail races under my belt. By the time I began my third loop, there were only 40 athletes out of nearly 100 left in the race, and I started running with a guy named Luis Escobar. For the 10th time, I heard the following words. "So, it's your first trail race," he asked. I nodded. "You really picked the wrong..." "I know," I said. "It's just such a technical right. I'm a fucking idiot. I've heard that a lot today." "That's okay," he said. "We're all a bunch of idiots out here, man." He handed me a water bottle. He was carrying three of them. "Take this. I heard about your Camelback." This being my second race, I was starting to understand the rhythm of Ultra. It's a constant dance between competition and camaraderie, which reminded me of Buds. Luis and I were both racing the clock and each other, but we wanted one another to make it. We were in it alone, together, and he was right. We were a couple of fucking idiots. Darkness descended and left us with a pitch-black jungle night. Running side by side, the glow of our headlamps merged and shed a wider light. But once we separated, all I could see was a yellow ball bouncing on the trail ahead of me. Countless tripwires, shin-high logs, slick roots, lichen-wrapped rocks remained out of sight. I slipped, stumbled, fell, and cursed. Jungle noises were everywhere. It wasn't just the insect world that had my attention. In Hawaii, on all the islands, bow hunting for wild pig in the mountains is a major pastime, and master hunters often leave their pit bulls chained up in the jungle to develop a nose for swine. I heard every one of those hungry bulls snapping and growling, and I heard some pigs squealing too. I smelled their fear and rage, their piss and shit, their sour fucking breath. With each nearby bark or yelp, my heart skipped, and I jumped on terrain so slick that injury was a real possibility. One wrong step could roll my ass out of the race and out of contention for Badwater. I could picture Kosman hearing the news and nodding like he figured that shit would happen all along. I know him pretty well now, and he was never out to get me, but that's how my mind worked back then. And in the steep, dark mountains of Oahu, my exhaustion magnified my stress. I felt close to my absolute limit, but still had more than 40 miles to go. On the backside of the course, after a long technical descent into the dark, dank forest, I saw another headlamp circling ahead of me and a cutout on the trail. The runner was moving in curlicues, and when I caught up to him, I could see it was a Hungarian runner I'd met in San Diego named Akos Konya. He was one of the best runners in the field on Hospitality Point, where he covered 134 miles in 24 hours. I liked Akos and had mad respect for him. I stopped and watched him move in conjoining circles, covering the same terrain over and over again. Was he looking for something? Was he hallucinating? "Akos," I asked. "You okay, man? Do you need some help?"
"David, no. I know.
I'm fine," he said. His eyes were full moon flying saucers. He was in delirium, but I was barely hanging on myself and wasn't sure what I could do for him other than tell staff at the next aid station he was wandering in a daze. Like I said, there's camaraderie and there's competition on the ultra circuit, and since he wasn't in obvious pain and refused my help, I had to go into barbarian mode. With two full laps to go, I had no choice but to keep moving. I staggered back to the start line and slumped into my chair, dazed. It was dark as space, the temperature was dropping, and rain was still pissing down. I was at the very edge of my capability and wasn't sure that I could take one more step. I felt like I drained 99% from my tank, at least. My gas light was on, my engine shuddering, yet I knew I had to find more if I was going to finish this race and get myself into Badwater. But how do you push yourself when pain is all you feel with every step, when agony is the feedback loop that permeates each cell in your body, begging you to stop? That's tricky, because the threshold for suffering is different for everybody. What's universal is the impulse to succumb, to feel like you've given everything you can and that you are justified in leaving a job undone. By now, I'm sure you can tell that it doesn't take much for me to become obsessed. Some criticize my level of passion, but I'm not down with the prevailing mentalities that tend to dominate American society these days. The ones that tell us to go with the flow or invite us to learn how to get more with less effort. Fuck that shortcut bullshit. The reason I embrace my own obsessions and demand and desire more of myself is because I've learned that it's only when I push beyond pain and suffering, past my perceived limitations, that I'm capable of accomplishing more, physically and mentally, in endurance races, but also in life as a whole. And I believe the same is true for you. The human body is like a stock car. We may look different on the outside, but under the hood, we all have huge reservoirs of potential and a governor impeding us from reaching our maximum velocity. In a car, the governor limits the flow of fuel and air so it doesn't burn too hot, which places a ceiling on performance. It's a hardware issue. The governor can easily be removed, and if you disable yours, watch your car rocket beyond 130 miles per hour. It's a subtler process in the human animal. Our governor is buried deep in our minds, intertwined with our very identity. It knows what and who we love and hate. It's read our whole life story and forms the way we see ourselves and how we like to be seen. It's the software that delivers personalized feedback in the form of pain and exhaustion, but also fear and insecurity. And it uses all of that to encourage us to stop before we risk it all. But here's the thing. It doesn't have absolute control. Unlike the governor in an engine, ours can't stop us unless we buy into its bullshit and agree to quit. Sadly, most of us give up when we've only given around 40% of our maximum effort. Even when we feel like we've reached our absolute limit, we still have 60% more to give. That's the governor in action. Once you know that to be true, it's simply a matter of stretching your pain tolerance, letting go of your identity and all your self-limiting stories, so you can get to 60%, then 80%, and beyond without giving up. I call this the 40% rule, and the reason it's so powerful is that if you follow it, you will unlock your mind to new levels of performance and excellence in sports and in life, and your rewards will run far deeper than mere material success. The 40% rule can be applied to everything we do, because in life, almost nothing will turn out exactly as we hope. There are always challenges, and whether we are at work or school or feeling tested within our most intimate or important relationships, we will all be tempted to walk away from commitments, give up on our goals and dreams, and sell our own happiness short at some point, because we will feel empty, like we have no more to give when we haven't tapped even half of the treasure buried deep in our minds, hearts, and souls. I know how it feels to be approaching an energetic dead end. I've been there too many times to count. I understand the temptation to sell short, but I also know that impulse is driven by your mind's desire for comfort, and it's not telling you the truth. It's your identity trying to find sanctuary, not help you grow. It's looking for status quo, not reaching for greatness or seeking wholeness. But the software update that you need to shut your governor down is no supersonic download. It takes 20 years to gain 20 years of experience. And the only way to move beyond your 40% is to callous your mind day after day, which means you'll have to chase pain like it's your damn job. Imagine you're a boxer, and on your first day in the ring, you take one on the chin. It's gonna hurt like fucking hell. But at year 10 of being a boxer, you won't be stopped by one punch. You'll be able to absorb 12 rounds of getting beat the fuck down and come back the very next day and fight again. It's not that the punch has lost power. Your opponents will be even stronger. The change has happened within your brain. You've calloused your mind. Over a period of time, your tolerance for mental and physical suffering will have expanded because your software will have learned that you can take a hell of a lot more than one punch. And if you stay with any task that is trying to beat you down, you will reap rewards. Not a fighter? Say you like to run, but have a broken pinky toe. I'll bet if you continue running on it, pretty soon you'll be able to run on broken legs. Sounds impossible, right? I know it's true, because I've run on broken legs, and that knowledge helped me endure all manner of agonies on the ultra circuit, which has revealed a clear spring of self-confidence that I drink from whenever my tank is dry. But nobody taps their reserve 60% right away, or all at once. The first step is to remember that your initial blast of pain and fatigue is your governor talking. Once you do that, you are in control of the dialogue in your mind, and you can remind yourself that you are not as drained as you think, that you haven't given it your all, not even close. Buying into that will keep you in the fight, and that's worth an extra 5%. Of course, that's easier said than done. It wasn't easy to begin the fourth lap of the Hurt 100, because I knew how much it would hurt. And when you are feeling dead and buried, dehydrated, wrung out, and torn the fuck up at 40%, finding that extra 60% feels impossible. I didn't want my suffering to continue. Nobody does. That's why the line, fatigue makes cowards of us all, is true as shit. Mind you, I didn't know anything about the 40% rule that day. The Hurt 100 is when I first started to contemplate it. But I had hit the wall many times before, and I had learned to stay present and open-minded enough to recalibrate my goals even at my lowest. I knew that staying in the fight is always the hardest and most rewarding first step. Of course, it's easy to be open-minded when you leave yoga class and are taking a stroll by the beach. But when you're suffering, keeping an open mind is hard work. The same is true if you're facing a daunting challenge on the job or at school. Maybe you are tackling a 100-question test and know that you've bricked the first 50. At that point, it's extremely difficult to maintain the necessary discipline to force yourself to keep taking the test seriously. It's also imperative that you find it, because in every failure, there is something to be gained, even if it's only practice for the next test you'll have to take. Because that next test is coming. That's a guarantee. I didn't start my fourth lap with any sort of conviction. I was in wait-and-see mode, and halfway up that first climb, I became so dizzy I had to sit under a tree for a while. Two runners passed me, one at a time. They checked in, but I waved them on, told them I was just fine. Yeah, I was doing great. I was a regular Akos Konya. From my vantage point, I could see the crest of the hill above and encouraged myself to walk at least that far. If I still wanted to quit after that, I told myself that I would be willing to sign off, and that there is no shame in not finishing the Hurt 100. I said that to myself again and again, because that's how our governor works. It massages your ego, even as it stops you short of your goals. But once I got to the top of the climb, the higher ground gave me a new perspective, and I saw another place, off in the distance, and decided to cover that small stretch of mud, rock, and root, too. You know, before quitting for good. Once I got there, I was staring down a long descent, and even though the footing was troubling, it still looked much easier than going uphill. Without realizing it, I'd gotten to a point where I was able to strategize. On the first climb, I was so dizzy and weak, I was swept into a moment of fuck, which clogged my brain. There was no room for strategy. I just wanted to quit. But by moving a little bit further, I'd reset my brain. I'd calm down and realize I could chunk the race down to size. And staying in the game like that gave me hope. And hope is addictive. I chunked the race out that way, collecting 5% chips, unlocking more energy, then burning it up as time bled into the wee hours. I became so tired I damn near fell asleep on my feet. And that's dangerous on a trail, with so many switchbacks and drop-offs. Any runner could have easily sleepwalked into oblivion. The one thing keeping me awake was the piss-poor trail condition. I fell on my ass dozens of times. My street shoes were out of their element. It felt like I was running on ice, and the inevitable fall was always jarring, but at least it woke me up. By running a little while, then walking a stretch, I was able to forge ahead to mile 77, the toughest descent of them all, which is when I saw Carl Meltzer, the speed goat, crest the hill behind me. He wore a lamp on his head, and another on his wrist, and a hip pack with two big water bottles. Silhouetted in pink dawn light, he charged down slope, navigating a section that had me stumbling and groping for tree branches to stay upright. He was about to lap me, 3 miles from the finish line, on pace for a course record, 22 hours and 16 minutes. But what I remember most is how graceful he looked running at an incredible 6 minute and 30 second per mile pace. He was levitating over the mud, riding a whole different zen. His feet barely touched the ground, and it was a beautiful fucking sight. The speed goat was the living, breathing answer to the question that colonized my mind after the Las Vegas marathon. What am I capable of? Watching that bad man glide across the most challenging terrain made me realize that there is a whole other level of athlete out there in the world, and that some of that was inside me too. In fact, it's in all of us. I'm not saying that genetics don't play a role in athletic performance, or that everyone has an undiscovered ability to run a 4-minute mile, dunk like LeBron James, shoot like Steph Curry, or run the Hurt 100 in 22 hours. We don't all have the same floor or ceiling, but we each have a lot more in us than we know. And when it comes to endurance sports, like ultra running, everyone can achieve feats they once thought impossible. In order to do that, we must change our minds, be willing to scrap our identity, and make the extra effort to always find more in order to become more. We must remove our governor. That day on the Hurt 100 circuit, after seeing Meltzer run like a superhero, I finished my fourth lap in all kinds of pain and took time to watch him celebrate, surrounded by his team. He'd just achieved something nobody had ever done before, and here I was with another full lap to go. My legs were rubber, my feet swollen. I did not want to go on, but I also knew that was my pain talking. My true potential was still undetermined. Looking back, I'd say I'd given 60%, which meant my tank was just shy of half full. I'd like to sit here and tell you I went all out and drained that fucker on lap 5, but I was still a mere tourist on Planet Ultra. I wasn't the master of my mind. I was in the laboratory, still in discovery mode, and I walked every single step of my 5th and final lap. It took me 8 hours, but the rain had stopped, the tropical glow of the warm Hawaiian sun felt phenomenal, and I got the job done. I finished Hurt 100 in 33 hours and 23 minutes, just shy of the 36-hour cutoff, good enough for 9th place. Only 23 athletes finished the entire race, and I was one of them. I was so thrashed afterward, two people carried me to the car, and Kate had to spin me up to my room in a damn wheelchair. When we got there, we had more work to do. I wanted to get my Badwater application done ASAP, so without so much as a cat nap, we polished that shit up. Within a matter of days, Kosman emailed me to let me know that I had been accepted into Badwater. It was a great feeling. It also meant that for the next 6 months, I had 2 full-time jobs. I was a Navy SEAL in full preparation mode for Badwater. This time, I would get strategic and specific because I knew that in order to unleash my best performance, if I wanted to blow past 40%, drain my tank, and tap my full potential, I had to first give myself an opportunity. I didn't research or prepare for the Hurt 100 well enough. I hadn't anticipated the rough terrain, I had no support crew for the first part of the race, and I had no backup water source. I didn't bring 2 headlamps, which would have helped during the long, bleak night, and though I sure felt like I had given everything I had, I never even had a chance to access my true 100%. You know, before we get into Badwater prep, I think we should just recap what just happened.
Yeah, this was another one and another one right here.
Right here. But now,
so I started realizing right here, well, I started figuring some things out going through, you know, my hell weeks, you know, all this other crap. That 100-mile race, the Las Vegas, you know, marathon. But what's the one thing? What's the one thing that you think, Adam, in this race right here that made me start to think about this 40% rule that I made up? What do you think is the one thing?
You know, I never asked you that question. What the one thing that made you start to think of that? And I have to say, it's Carl Meltzer.
Carl Meltzer was a little fraction of that. But what it was, as you're reading this, is there anybody around me? Am I racing anybody? I'm truly alone. So I was alone in my own thoughts, in my own mind.
For a long time.
For a long time.
It's like a hell week without anybody around you.
Right. And I'm talking about, even though it's a 5-loop course, man, it's almost like you're out there by yourself. There's almost 100 people out there. And once I got past, you know, me and Luis Escobar kind of split off and he took off, I saw Akos. And then I saw Carl Meltzer. That was it. You know, I had like another 30 miles or whatever it was left. And I was out there just walking around this daggone jungle, triple canopy jungle, by myself.
With nothing to feed off, nobody to feed off but yourself.
Exactly. So then I went into my mind to that cookie jar I was talking about. And I started thinking about, okay, man, I need more ways to get through this, man. How am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? And the one thing I realized is it's impossible to find that whole 40% rule, find more, find 60, 70, 80% if you're competing. If you're competing against somebody, that's not the time to start trying to find more. When you're by yourself, you can do a live autopsy because you're not competing with anybody. You're competing against yourself and only yourself. And my best races always came when I went into the race just against David Goggins. There may be 1,000 people in the race, but when I ran my own race and was in my own head and did my own thing, that's exactly where this starts. So that's why I was able to figure out all these different tools over the 40%. Cause I was, okay, how can I get from here to there?
You're saying that when you're trying to defeat an opponent in a race or a competition without focusing on just what you have to do to get through the race at your full potential, you actually get less strategic. You get kind of out of your body.
Right. What happens is when you're racing somebody, you start to run their race.
Mm.
And then you didn't train the way they did.
No.
You trained the way you did. So this gave me a lot of time to start figuring out my mind. Like I said, I became a scientist. And I was the project.
Mm.
I was the project. I was like, okay, let me see. I'm at mile 40 and I'm done.
You were your own monster.
Exactly. I'm destroyed. So, you know, let's create, who is it, Frankenstein?
Yes.
And that's what I did.
Frankenstein, you became your own Frankenstein's monster.
That's it, man. And that's exactly, I had time out there by myself to think about the possibilities and how can I get from here to there? I'm broken. And it started right here.
So that's where it started. But, you know, now it's kind of a fully formed thing, the 40% rule. So we don't really go back into it. We don't really, with these principles, we don't then talk about the years later that you polished it.
Right.
About how long was it before you kind of really put a name to it and really understood it as a rule? Was it 5 years? Was it 10 years? How long was it before you really realized, you know, hey, this is the 40%. This is the governor. This is everything.
I believe I was doing an interview around 2008.
Okay.
Somewhere around there. So I did a race called it was called McNaughton. It was a 150-mile race. That's not in the book. It was a 150-mile race, and the first year I did it, I went out there and got double pneumonia and walked with a guy named Mike. We have to talk about Mike here in the book. A guy named Mike, I walked 90 miles. Oh, my fault. No.
Ryan Dexter?
No. This was Mike.
Okay.
The guy we talked about who's in New York.
Yeah.
With the family.
Oh, that's him. Right.
So basically what happened was I ran the first 90 miles of a 150-mile race, and at mile 90, I was destroyed. Something happened. I had double pneumonia. Once again, those lung issues came up, and I decided to walk the next 60 miles, and Mike walked with me. The second time I went back, I literally said to everybody, I'm going to come back out here the very next year, and I'm going to crush this course. And I went back out, and I beat the course record by like 2 hours, and I beat my previous time by like 8 hours. And this company for Lexus was following me around this track, it was like a 10-mile loop, and I did it 15 times for 100 miles. It's in trails. It was nasty, muddy, raining, cold as hell. And this Lexus person was talking to me the whole time. They actually, you know, didn't work for Lexus. I guess Lexus hired him for some commercial and they were doing whatever. And that's where I came up with it at. Because I was out there and I was like, man, you know what? I started having more time to reflect on how much I was leaving on the table. But then I started figuring out there's actually steps on how to break down that governor that we put on our minds.
Right.
So I started figuring out the steps. It wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to push harder. No, it wasn't like that. All these different, there's actually steps on how to open that up. But nowadays, a lot of people don't want to do that. Why? Because it is so comfortable nowadays. Life is so comfortable. It's so easy to be comfortable. I'm looking around and here in LA, you know, we're here doing this audiobook. Everybody has some little scooter. You know, I'm like, what the hell's all these damn scooters, man? I'm like, hey, walk your ass to the fucking store. Everybody's got either a sit down scooter, a stand up scooter.
Yeah.
You know, all these bikes that, you know, you have to pay for, those bikes are all rusted and crushed. Nobody's getting a bike. I got a scooter.
Right.
So the mind is just getting weaker and weaker and weaker. So trying to find this extra 60%, you really have to go back to the granimalistic mindset that we had back in the day.
Love it. But long before that, well, a few years before that, you're still kind of a neophyte, like you said, in Planet
Huge
Ultra.
Neophyte. Huge.
But you knew that there was so much more. I mean, you were done after three laps. I mean, you were trashed and yet you did 40 more miles of this hellish course and you hadn't even really prepared. You hadn't really even put yourself in a position to get to 100. So you knew there was this gap there.
Oh, 100%. Because this gave me a lot of time also in the Hurt 100 to think about the first 100-mile race I did with no training. And then going out to the daggone Las Vegas Marathon, I'm thinking, God, dog. So that actually gave me tons of fuel to start discovering even more in this race. Because I was once again, the cookie jar, I went back in the cookie jar in my mind, started thinking, hang on a second, David, you're broke down at mile 40, but you were shitting on yourself at mile 70 in the first race you did.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, we got some more.
Badwater was going to be different. I researched day and night. I studied the course, noted temperature and elevation variances, and charted them out. I wasn't just interested in the air temperature. I drilled down deeper, so I knew how hot the pavement would be on the hottest Death Valley day ever. I Googled videos of the race and watched them for hours. I read blogs from runners who completed it. I noted their pitfalls and training techniques. I drove north to Death Valley and explored the entire course. Seeing the terrain up close revealed its brutality. The first 42 miles were dead flat. A run through God's blast furnace cranked up high. That would be my best opportunity to make good time. But to survive it, I'd need two crew vehicles to leapfrog one another and set up cooling stations every third of a mile. The thought of it thrilled me, but then again, I wasn't living it yet. I was listening to music, windows down on a spring day in a blooming desert. I was comfortable as hell. It was all still a fucked up fantasy. I marked off the best spots to set up my cooling stations. I noted wherever the shoulder was wide and where stopping would have to be avoided. I also took note of gas stations and other places to fill up on water and buy ice. There weren't many of them, but they were all mapped. After running the desert gauntlet, I'd earn some relief from the heat and pay for it with altitude. The next stage of the race was an 18-mile climb to Town Pass at 4,800 feet. The sun would be setting by then, and after driving that section, I pulled over, closed my eyes, and visualized it all. Research is one part of preparation. Visualization is another. Following that Town Pass climb, I would face a bone-crushing 9-mile descent. I could see it unfurl from the top of the pass. One thing I learned from the Hurt 100 is that running downhill fucks you up bad, and this time I'd be doing it on asphalt. I closed my eyes, opened my mind, and tried to feel the pain in my quads and calves, knees and shins. I knew my quads would bear the brunt of that descent, so I made a note to add muscle. My thighs would need to be plated in steel. The 18-mile climb up Darwin Pass from mile 72 would be pure hell. I'd have to run-walk that section. But the sun would be down, I'd welcome the chill in Lone Pine, and from there I could make up some time because that's where the road flattened out again before the final 13-mile climb up Whitney Portal Road to the finish line at 8,374 feet. Then again, it's easy to write, make up time in your notepad, and another to execute it when you get there in real life. But at least I had notes. Together with my annotated maps, they made up my Badwater file, which I studied like I was preparing for another ASVAB test. I sat at my kitchen table, read and reread them, and visualized each mile the best I could. But I also knew that my body still hadn't recovered from Hawaii, which hampered the other, even more important aspect of my Badwater prep, physical training. I was in dire need of PT, but my tendons still hurt so bad I couldn't run for months. Pages were flying off the calendar. I needed to get harder and become the strongest runner possible, and the fact that I couldn't train like I'd hoped sapped my confidence. Plus, word had gotten out at work about what I was getting myself into, and while I had some support from fellow SEALs, I got my share of negativity too, especially when they found out I still couldn't run. But that was nothing new. Who hasn't dreamed up a possibility for themselves only to have friends, colleagues, or family shit all over it? Most of us are motivated as hell to do anything to pursue our dreams until those around us remind us of the danger, the downside, our own limitations, and all the people before us that didn't make it. Sometimes the advice comes from a well-intentioned place. They really believe they are doing it for our own good, but if you let them, these same people will talk you out of your dreams, and your governor will help them do it. That's one reason I invented the cookie jar. We must create a system that constantly reminds us who the fuck we are when we are at our best, because life is not going to pick us up when we fall. There will be forks in the road, knives in your fucking back, mountains to climb, and we are only capable of living up to the image we create for ourselves. Prepare yourself. We know life can be hard, and yet we feel sorry for ourselves when it isn't fair. From this point forward, accept the following is Goggins' laws of nature. You will be made fun of. You will feel insecure. You may not be the best all the time. You may be the only black, white, Asian, Latino, female, male, gay, lesbian, or fill in your identity here in a given situation. There will be times when you feel alone. Get over it. Our minds are fucking strong. They are our most powerful weapon, but we have stopped using them. We have access to so many more resources today than ever before, yet we are so much less capable than those who came before us. If you want to be one of the few to defy those trends in our ever-softening society, you will have to be willing to go to war with yourself and create a whole new identity, which requires an open mind. It's funny. Being open-minded is often tagged as new age or soft. Fuck that. Being open-minded enough to find a way is old school. It's what knuckle-draggers do. And that's exactly what I did. I borrowed my friend Stokes' bike. He also graduated in class 235. And instead of running to work, I rode there and back every day. There was an elliptical trainer in the brand new SEAL Team 5 gym, and I hit it once and sometimes twice a day, with 5 layers of clothes on. Death Valley heat scared the shit out of me, so I simulated it. I suited up in 3 or 4 pairs of sweatpants and a few pullover sweatshirts, a hoodie and a fleece hat, all sealed up in a Gore-Tex shell. After 2 minutes on the elliptical, my heart rate was at 170, and I stayed at it for 2 hours at a time. Before or after that, I'd hop on the rowing machine and bang out 30,000 meters, which is nearly 20 miles. I never did anything for 10 or 20 minutes. My entire mindset was ultra. It had to be. Afterward, I could be seen wringing my clothes out like I just soaked them in a river. Most of the guys thought I was whacked out, but my old buds instructor, SBG, fucking loved it. That spring, I was tasked as a land warfare instructor for SEALs at our base in Nyland, California. A sorry scrap of Southern California desert, its trailer parks rampant with unemployed meth heads. Drugged out drifters who filtered through the disintegrating settlements on the Salton Sea, an inland body of water 60 miles from the Mexico border, were our only neighbors. Whenever I passed them on the street while out on a 10-mile ruck, they'd stare like I was an alien that had materialized into the real world from one of their speed-addled vision quests. Then again, I was dressed in 3 layers of clothes and a Gore-Tex jacket in peak 100-degree heat. I did look like some evil messenger from the way out beyond. By then, my injuries had become manageable, and I ran 10 miles at a time, then hiked the hills around Nyland for hours, weighed down with a 50-pound ruck. The team guys I was training considered me an alien being, too, and a few of them were more frightened of me than the meth heads. They thought something had happened to me on the battlefield out in that other desert where war wasn't a game. What they didn't know was the battlefield for me was my own mind. I drove back out to Death Valley to train and did a 10-mile run in a sauna suit. That motherfucker was hot as balls, but I had the hardest race in the world ahead of me, and I'd run 100 miles twice. I knew how that felt, and the prospect of having to take on an additional 35 miles petrified me. Sure, I talked a good game, projected all kinds of confidence, and raised tens of thousands of dollars. But part of me didn't know if I had what it took to finish the race, so I had to invent barbaric PT to give myself a chance. It takes a lot of will to push yourself when you are all alone. I hated getting up in the morning, knowing what the day held for me. It was very lonely, but I knew that on the Badwater course, I'd reach a point where the pain would become unbearable and feel insurmountable. Maybe it would be at mile 50 or 60, maybe later, but there would be a time when I'd want to quit, and I had to be able to slay the one-second decisions in order to stay in the game and access my untapped 60%. During all the lonely hours of heat training, I'd started to dissect the quitting mind and realized that if I was going to perform close to my absolute potential and make the Warrior Foundation proud, I'd have to do more than answer the simple question as they came up. I'd have to stifle the quitting mind before it gained any traction at all. Before I ever asked myself why, I'd need my cookie jar on recall to convince me that despite what my body was saying, I was immune to suffering. Because nobody quits an ultra race or hell week in a split second. People make the decision to quit hours before they ring that bell. So I needed to be present enough to recognize when my body and mind were starting to fail in order to short-circuit the impulse to look for a way out, long before I tumbled into that fatal funnel. Ignoring pain or blocking out the truth like I did at the San Diego One Day would not work this time. And if you are on the hunt for your 100%, you should catalog your weaknesses and vulnerabilities. Don't ignore them. Be prepared for them, because in any endurance event, in any high-stress environment, your weaknesses will surface like bad karma, build in volume, and overwhelm you, unless you get ahead of them first. This is an exercise in recognition and visualization. You must recognize what you are about to do, highlight what you do not like about it, and spend time visualizing each and every obstacle you can. I was afraid of the heat, so in the run-up to Badwater, I imagined new and more medieval self-torture rituals disguised as training sessions. Or maybe it was the other way around. I told myself I was immune to suffering, but that didn't mean I was immune to pain. I hurt like everybody else, but I was committed to working my way around and through it so it would not derail me. By the time I towed up to the line at Badwater at 6 a.m. on July 22, 2006, I'd moved my governor to 80%. I doubled my ceiling in 6 months. And you know what that guaranteed me? Jack fucking shit. Badwater has a staggered start. Rookies started at 6 a.m. Veteran runners had an 8 a.m. start. And the true contenders wouldn't take off until 10 a.m., which put them in Death Valley for peak heat. Chris Kossman was one hilarious son of a bitch. But he didn't know he'd given one hard motherfucker a serious tactical advantage. Not me. I'm talking about Akos Konya. Akos and I met up the night before at the Furnace Creek Inn, where all the athletes stayed. He was a first-timer, too, and he looked a hell of a lot better since the last time we saw one another. Despite his issues at the Hurt 100, he finished, by the way, in 35 hours and 17 minutes. I knew Akos was a stud, and since we were both in the first group, I let him pace me through the desert. Bad call. For the first 17 miles, we were side by side, and we looked like an odd couple. Akos is a 5'7", 122-pound Hungarian. I was the biggest man in the field at 6'1", 195 pounds, and the only black guy, too. Akos was sponsored and dressed in a colorful branded getup. I wore a torn gray tank top, black running shorts, and streamlined Oakley sunglasses. My feet and ankles were wrapped in compression tape and stuffed into broken-in but still springy running shoes. I didn't wear Navy SEAL gear or Warrior Foundation garb. I preferred to go incognito. I was the shadow figure filtering into a new world of pain. Although Akos set a fast pace, the heat didn't bother me, partly because it was early and because I'd heat trained so well. We were the two best runners in the 6 a.m. group by far, and when we passed the Furnace Creek Inn at 8:40 a.m., some of the runners from the 10 a.m. group were outside, including Scott Jurek, the defending champion, Badwater record holder, and an ultra legend. He must have known we were making great time, but I'm not sure he realized that he just glimpsed his stiffest competition. Not long after, Akos put some space between us, and at mile 26, I started to realize that, once again, I went out way too fast. I was dizzy and lightheaded, and I was dealing with GI issues. Translation, I had to shit on the side of the road. All of which stemmed from the fact that I was severely dehydrated. My mind spun with dire prognosis after dire prognosis. Excuses to quit piled up one after another. I didn't listen. I responded by taking care of my dehydration issue and pounding more water than I wanted. I went through the Stovepipe Wells checkpoint at mile 42 at 1:31 p.m., a full hour after Akos. I'd been on the race course for over 7.5 hours and was almost exclusively walking by then. I was proud just to have made it through Death Valley on my feet. I took a break, went to a proper bathroom, and changed my clothes. My feet had swollen more than I'd expected, and my right big toe had been chafing the side of the shoe for hours, so stopping felt like sweet relief. I felt the bloom of a blood blister on the side of my left foot, but I knew better than to take off my shoes. Most athletes size up their shoes to run Badwater, and even then, they cut out the big toe side panel to create space for swelling and to minimize chafing. I did not, and I had 90 more miles ahead of me. I hiked the entire 18-mile climb to Town Pass at 4,850 feet. As predicted, the sun dropped as I crested the pass. The air cooled, and I pulled on another layer. In the military, we always say we don't rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training. And as I hiked up the winding highway with my blister barking, I fell into the same rhythm I'd find on my long rucks in the desert around Nyland. I wasn't running, but I kept a strong pace and covered a lot of ground. I stuck to my script, ran the entire 9-mile descent, and my quads paid the price. So did my left foot. My blister was growing by the minute. I could feel it verging on hot air balloon status. If only it would burst through the side of my shoe like an old cartoon and continue to expand until it carried me into the clouds and dropped me onto the peak of Mount Whitney itself. No such luck. I kept walking. And aside from my crew, which included, among others, my wife, Kate was crew chief, and mother, I didn't see anybody else. I was on an eternal ruck, marching beneath a black dome sky glittering with starlight. I'd been walking for so long I expected a swarm of runners to materialize at any moment, then leave me in their wake. But nobody showed. The only evidence of life on planet Pain was the rhythm of my own hot breath, the burn of my cartoon blister, and the high beams and red taillights of road trippers, blazing trails through the California night. That is, until the sun was ready to rise, and the swarm finally did arrive at mile 110. I was exhausted and dehydrated by then, glazed in sweat, dirt, and salt, when horseflies began to dive bomb me one at a time. Two became four, which became 10 and 15. They beat their wings against my skin, bit my thighs, and crawled into my ears. This shit was biblical, and it was my very last test. My crew took turns swatting flies off my skin with a towel. I was in personal best territory already. I'd covered more than 110 miles on foot, and with only 25 miles to go, there was no fucking way these devil flies would stop me. Would they? I kept marching, and my crew kept swatting flies for the next 8 miles. Since watching Akos run away from me after mile 17, I hadn't seen another Badwater runner until mile 122, when Kate pulled up alongside me. "Scott Jurek is 2 miles behind you," she said. We were more than 26 hours into the race, and Akos had already finished, but the fact that Jurek was just now catching me meant my time must have been pretty damn good. I hadn't run much, but all those Nyland rucks made my hiking strides swift and strong. I was able to power hike 15-minute miles and got my nutrition on the move to save time. After it was all over, when I examined the splits and finishing times of all the competitors, I realized my biggest fear, the heat, had actually helped me. It was the great equalizer. It made fast runners slow. With Jurek on the hunt, I was inspired to give it everything I had as I turned onto Whitney Portal Road and started the final 13-mile climb. I flashed onto my pre-race strategy to walk the slopes and run the flats as the road switched back like a snake, slithering into the clouds. Jurek wasn't pursuing me, but he was on the chase. Akos had finished in 25 hours and 58 minutes, and Jurek hadn't been at his best that day. The clock was winding down on his effort to repeat as Badwater champion, but he had the tactical advantage of knowing Akos's time in advance. He also knew his splits. Akos hadn't had that luxury, and somewhere on the highway, he'd stopped for a 30-minute nap. Jurek wasn't alone. He had a pacer, a formidable runner in his own right named Dusty Olsen, who nipped at his heels. Word was, Olsen ran at least 70 miles of the race himself. I heard them approach from behind, and whenever the road switched back, I could see them below me. Finally, at mile 128, on the steepest part of the steepest road in this entire fucked-up race, they were right behind me. I stopped running, got out of the way, and cheered them on. Jurek was the fastest ultra-runner in history at that point, but his pace wasn't electric that late in the game. It was consistent. He chopped down the mighty mountain with each deliberate step. He wore black running shorts, a blue sleeveless shirt, and a white baseball cap. Behind him, Olsen had his long, shoulder-length hair corralled with a bandana. Otherwise, their uniform was identical. Jurek was the mule, and Olsen was riding him. "Come on, Jerker! Come on, Jerker! This is your race!" Olsen said as they passed me up. "No one is better than you. No one!" Olsen kept talking as they ran ahead, reminding Jurek that he had more to give. Jurek obliged and kept charging up the mountain. He left it all out on that unforgiving asphalt. It was amazing to watch. Jurek wound up winning the 2006 edition of Badwater when he finished in 25 hours and 41 minutes, 17 minutes faster than Akos, who must have regretted his power nap. But that wasn't my concern. I had a race of my own to finish. Whitney Portal Road winds up a parched, exposed rock escarpment for 10 miles before finding shade and gathering stands of cedar and pine. Energized by Jurek and his crew, I ran most of the last 7 miles. I used my hips to push my legs forward, and every single step was agony. But after 30 hours, 18 minutes, and 54 seconds of running, hiking, sweating, and suffering, I snapped the tape to the cheers of a small crowd. I'd wanted to quit 30 times. I had to mentally inch my way through 135 miles. But 90 runners competed that day, and I came in 5th place. I plodded over to a grassy slope in the woods and lay back on a bed of pine needles as Kate unlaced my shoes. That blister had fully colonized my left foot. It was so big it looked like a 6th toe, the color and texture of cherry bubblegum. I marveled at it while she removed the compression tape from my feet. Then I staggered to the stage to accept my medal from Kosman. I just finished one of the hardest races on planet Earth. I'd visualized that moment 10 times at least and thought I'd be elated, but I wasn't. He handed me my medal, shook my hand, and interviewed me for the crowd, but I was only half there. While he spoke, I flashed to the final climb and a pass above 8,000 feet, where the view was unreal. I could see all the way to Death Valley. Near the end of another horrible journey, I got to see where I came from. It was the perfect metaphor for my twisted life. Once again, I was broken, destroyed 20 different ways, but I'd passed another evolution, another crucible, and my reward was a lot more than a medal and a few minutes with Kosman's microphone. It was a whole new bar. I closed my eyes and saw Jurek and Olsen, Akos and Carl Meltzer. All of them had something I didn't. They understood how to drain every last drop and put themselves in a position to win the world's most difficult races. And it was time to seek out that feeling for myself. I'd prepared like a madman. I knew myself and the terrain. I stayed ahead of the quitting mind, answered the simple questions, and stayed in the race. But there was more to be done. There was still somewhere higher for me to rise. A cool breeze rustled the trees, dried the sweat from my skin, and soothed my aching bones. It whispered in my ear and shared a secret which echoed in my brain like a drumbeat that wouldn't stop. There is no finish line, Goggins. There is no finish line.
I absolutely loved that race. That race taught me a lot. And what's funny about that, I was going back through it, and that whole little grassy, that grassy area with the tree where I kind of went over to.
Yep.
And my ex-wife now, she's not my ex-wife, she was taking the tape off of my feet because I actually, as you know, the listener knows now, I had to tape up my ankles with compression tape, and she was taking it off. But how that all came to be, I believe the movie, they actually did like a documentary on the on Badwater 135, and I think it's called Running on the Sun.
Hmm.
And it kind of featured a guy named Gabriel Flores, and I think the guy's name was Eric Clifton, or just something like that. Anyway, but I watched a guy named Gabriel Flores, and I watched this video probably 200 times from the time I got in the Badwater race to the time I did the Badwater race. And Gabriel Flores came in second place that year. The year before the documentary, he actually won the race. So I wanted to see how he ran the race. I was trying to get ideas from him, how his crewing was, how his pacing was, all these different things. But what I saw was the very end of the race. He's going up the mountain. He's all messed up, and his crew's asking him questions. Hey, why are you out here? And I think he just said, you know, he said pride or what's keeping you going? He said pride. So he comes up the mountain. He gets to the very top of the mountain, and the same spot that I went and sat down at, you know, when I crossed the finish line was the same spot Gabriel Flores crossed. And the whole reason why I'm telling you the story was I was visualizing that spot for about 120 miles. I was visualizing that movie. I was visualizing, you know, me driving through Death Valley, all the checkpoints. But I was visualizing Gabriel Flores sitting down or laying down under that one tree in that one little grassy area. And if you all go to Badwater videos, just Google Badwater 135, 2006, David Goggins. And you'll see my ex-wife taking the tape off me. And that one spot that I'm sitting in, I visualized that one spot a million times. So it's just an interesting story.
That's interesting. And what I like about this whole thing is, unlike Hurt 100, you got some miles in for that and San Diego one day. This really does show when you prepare, like you break down here, that it can have success because of Nyland, you were able to power hike,
right,
which probably kept you in the race, right? If you had felt like you'd had to run, it would have been harder for you.
The only thing was that,
You found a rhythm in the power hike. The heat training worked. I mean, you had so much that worked. You know, you had your two vehicles, all that worked. So much of your preparation worked. So that had to be really encouraging for you. And part of the reason you felt like you could go even higher.
Well, I'm glad you talked about those two things, because those two things, I went back to my accountability mirror and I wrote down what are my weaknesses? I'm not a great runner. So I put that on my board. Not a great runner. Second of all, I was not great in the heat. So I kept repeating those things, and they kind of, I was afraid of them. So literally, man, I was like, well, I guarantee you at about mile 40 or 50, man, my body's going to break down. So I had to really get that hiking muscle going. And if you run a lot and you don't walk, you can run a 5-minute mile. But if you haven't hiked a lot, you're not going to be a good runner, you know, like a good hiker. So I started, you know, working those different muscle groups, hiking a ton uphill. So I realized also at about mile 90, 100, I'm going to feel like shit. So I need to kind of mimic how I'm going to feel. So I put that 50-pound rucksack on, you know, during my training. And I lived in the sauna because I knew that the one thing that gets people out there is the heat, and it's the great equalizer, and it made it fast runner slow, as we talked about here.
Hmm. You know, I was just in Lone Pine, Bishop Berry in the Sierra Nevadas, and as we were driving up, those fucking horse flies started buzzing around.
Come on, man.
One of those horse flies landed on my fucking windshield when we were stopped at a light, like in Bishop or Lone Pine or something.
Yeah, that's where they're at.
And I said to my wife, I'm like, that's one of those flies. And she could not fucking believe it because she'd read that.
Dude.
And she couldn't even fucking believe a swarm of those motherfuckers.
It was biblical. It was literally biblical. And another thing that jacked me up. So I'm out there running, and I always heard stories about people frying eggs on the daggone pavement out there.
Mm.
And so, you know, like, hey, you got to run on the white line because the daggone, you know, pavement's like, you know, it's like 220 or whatever. I was like, man, this is a bunch of bullshit. I'll never forget going through mile 42 at Stovepipe Wells, and this guy was out there frying an egg on the pavement just to make you think, what the fuck am I doing out here?
Mm.
And I was like, and I looked down and I said, my God, man, this is some hot shit. So yeah, it was a no joke race.
Crazy, dude.
And I also have a picture of my toe in the book.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's it's a nice, great picture of that nice. It looks like like you got a red balloon.
Yeah.
You kind of blew it up and put it over my toe.
That's it. That's where we got the description from, man.
Exactly.
Very good. All right, let's give these guys a challenge because it's time for our listeners and readers to start to ratchet up and find some of that extra 60% that they've been kind of leaving in the tank. Challenge number 7. The main objective here is to slowly start to remove the governor from your brain. First, a quick reminder of how this process works. In 1999, when I weighed 297 pounds, my first run was a quarter mile. Fast forward to 2007, I ran 205 miles in 39 hours, nonstop. I didn't get there overnight, and I don't expect you to either. Your job is to push past your normal stopping point. Whether you are running on a treadmill or doing a set of push-ups, get to the point where you are so tired and in pain that your mind is begging you to stop. Then push just 5 to 10% further. If the most push-ups you have ever done is 100 in a workout, do 105 or 110. If you normally run 30 miles each week, run 10% more next week. This gradual ramp-up will help prevent injury and allow your body and mind to slowly adapt to your new workload. It also resets your baseline, which is important because you're about to increase your workload another 5 to 10% the following week and the week after that. There is so much pain and suffering involved in physical challenges that it's the best training to take command of your inner dialogue. And the newfound mental strength and confidence you gain by continuing to push yourself physically will carry over to other aspects in your life. You will realize that if you are underperforming in your physical challenges, there is a good chance you are underperforming at school and work too. The bottom line is that life is one big mind game. The only person you are playing against is yourself. Stick with this process, and soon what you thought was impossible will be something you do every fucking day of your life. I want to hear your stories. Post on social. Hashtag can't hurt me. Hashtag the 40% rule. Hashtag don't get comfortable. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, just one quick thing. Understand this. There's a big caution in this whole chapter. Do not do what I did. That is, and what I mean by that is, I figured out the 40% rule from literally destroying myself. Don't go out here and say, oh, David Goggins ran 100 miles, no training. Oh, I can go do that. You might be able to, but the whole thing about it is, you have to do this 5, 10. Some of you maybe will go 20% more. But the whole thing is don't go from 0 to 100 because it will jack you up.
Yeah, I mean, just do it as you prescribe here, 5 to 10% each week. And the point is, if you do that, you'll realize there isn't, it's infinite where you can go.
100%.
You'll never get to 100. That's the point.
Matter of fact, I put a ceiling on mine for a little bit because I jacked my body up so much, I wasn't able to heal. So I was, you know, running, taping myself up, trying to find different heel wedges and different inserts just to run. So when your body's broken, you know, I had to go so deep in my mind to pull it off that, you know, it was unbelievable. So don't do it my way. Do it this way.